Kathleen was originally from Limerick, and she was from a family with very strong Fenian connections. And her uncle, John Daly, was very strong in the movement, and he actually was arrested when she was a youngster. So I think she was only about 5 or 6 when, in her memoirs, according to her, she started to become aware very much of everything that was happening in Ireland. So she grew up in quite a political household. So she met Tom because he was actually in prison with her uncle, and he came to visit them, and that's how she met Thomas Clarke. And it's funny because, you know, even though it's a fit wife for a revolutionary, I have the strongest feeling that regardless of whether she had met Thomas Clarke or not, Kathleen would have been involved in everything that happened with Ireland, because she came from that kind of a background, and she was such a fierce woman. She was a really strong-minded, independent woman.
A lot was always asked of her, wasn't it?
She doesn't feel like a lot was asked of her, do you know what I mean? But I mean, when you and I are looking back over her story and you see what she went through, she sacrificed an awful lot. She lost her brother and her husband and so many of her friends. And she, as the play describes and as we know, she was the one woman that was compelled to stay inside that week, because she had to bring all of the movement on, and she had to set up the dependence funds for all of the families and the widows and everybody who was left behind. So she was there for the planning of it, had to kind of step back for the actual event, and then had to carry the whole thing forward. So yeah, she had a lot on her shoulders.
Why did they choose her?
This is actually a really lovely moment that we have isolated in the show as well. She knew that they needed to select somebody, and they needed to be reliable and capable and discreet, and somebody that would be fully acquainted with everything, and somebody who would have the mind, I suppose, to be able to, you know, go through the finances and take all the reports and divide everything, and somebody that could give all of the information to. And I suppose a woman is somebody that nobody would suspect. She was just his wife in the eyes of the neighbours on the street. Do you know what I mean?
So your play looks at that week.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
To me, it fascinated me because I knew she had people calling in and out at the beginning of the week in the early stages, because it's almost like her home became a hub of activity where people would be running with messages, and they'd have dispatches and runners going from garrison to garrison. And she, for the first couple of days, was at home, but she was involved. And then for me, when I was reading her memoirs, what really stuck with me is just the loneliness after the first couple of days, when the rising heated up and when it got into the thick of the fighting. She was on her own, and I just can't even imagine. I mean, I've had to imagine because I've had to write it, but it was just overwhelming even thinking about being in that position with everybody you know out there in the middle of everything and just not being able to leave. It's that feeling of claustrophobia and of just being left alone with the thoughts that you could possibly have running through your mind. You know, you'd go to the darkest places, I'm sure she did in that week. So yeah, we've kind of written the play so that we structured it so that it goes from the Good Friday, so 2 days before the fighting was due to start, right through to that week. And she didn't know what was happening. She didn't know if Tom was dead or alive, if they had surrendered, if they had won, if he'd been arrested. She had no idea. So we follow her through the entire week until she gets a knock on the door, which is almost where we end the play.
I have actually seen a couple of little clips on YouTube of her speaking in older years about the two farewells when he left to join the Rising.
And yes.
The night before he was executed, and stiff upper lip just doesn't describe it.
No, and what she constantly said was, you know, she needed to be strong for him, and that they never really got over emotional, because she uses a lovely phrase where she said, you know, we knew it would break us. And that was her mantra, I think, the whole week. You know, you don't break in front of them. You keep your head held high. And just the strength that she even had to do that. It's funny, there's almost three farewells, because she says goodbye to him when he's going into hiding the night before it was due to start. And then, of course, the Rising was due to start on Easter Sunday, but there was a counter order sent out and there was a lot of confusion, so they had to put the whole thing back. So he arrived back home. So she had to say goodbye to him again the next morning. But this time, I think there was a sense of hope the first time, whereas they knew, he knew, she knew, that the whole thing was doomed, but they had gone too far to not do it now. They couldn't stop it now. The wheels were already in motion. So I think that when she was saying goodbye to him that second time, there was a definite sense of foreboding that this was not going to go the way that they had hoped. And then, of course, the farewell in Kilmainham Jail, which is just, reading what she wrote in her memoirs about it, it's a fascinating conversation, but we didn't want to put Thomas on the stage or even pretend that he was on the stage because we want the show to be about her. So we've left that one alone. And also because I think it's so intimate between the two of them, you couldn't portray it justly, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we've concentrated on the saying goodbyes before he leaves, and I've just left that one.
And I was also struck by she didn't tell him that she was pregnant.
That's right.
She saved him that.
Yeah. And again, that was something that we toyed with putting into the play. And I've been in touch with her relatives as well, a couple of her relatives who are still alive, Helen Litton, who actually edited her memoirs. And I met her for coffee in Dublin before Christmas just to tell her how it was going. And that was a question that I asked. And I said, you know what, to me, she lost the baby a few days later, and she never told him that she was pregnant. And to me, that's something so personal. And Helen's take on it was, it is personal, but it is one of the things that people remember really strongly when they think of Kathleen and they think of that goodbye. And she put it in her memoirs, so it's out there. So I debated whether or not to put that in, but like that, it is something that sticks with people because it humanises the whole thing, you know, it makes it real. And it also, I think, shows another element to what the women went through at that time, do you know, who were fighting and who were out there and who were part of it. Like, she was pregnant for the entire week, which is just another, for me as a performer, it's another thing to kind of having to bear in mind. So it's quite a sad, sad part of her story.
I spoke about her to my son last night and said she was formidable, and he said, well, she's Irish. But she was extraordinary because she eventually lived to 94, but she was a TD, an Irish Member of Parliament.
She was the first Lord Mayor of Dublin, the first female Lord Mayor of Dublin, and she did quite a lot. Also, I think one of her big passions was to try and get Ireland the Red Cross branch unit, because officially they didn't have one during the rising. So even though the Cumann na mBan members and all the nurses were out in the streets and they had a red cross that they had emblazoned on their uniforms, it didn't really offer them any protection because technically they were supposed to be aligned to the British Army. So she had looked to try and get an independent Irish branch before that, and it had been declined. So one of her real passions was to try and make that happen. So she's responsible for that as well and so much more. Yeah, she really went on to have quite a prestigious career in politics.
And she wasn't afraid to disagree with the powers that be, was she?
No, she really wasn't. And she says that, you know, she talks about her duty and her love for Ireland, and a lot of the times, even in the play, where, you know, she has to make decisions or she'll stand up to something or stand up to somebody, and she does it in such an elegant way but gets her point across. And even that, the title of the play is actually, it's a neighbour who started, you know, having a disagreement with her in the garden during the week of the rising about what was going on, because she had family herself who were out fighting, and kind of landing the blame at Kathleen's door, if you like. And they had a conversation about it. She doesn't go into too much detail, but by the end of it, the woman, her final parting words to her were, well, you're a fit wife for a revolutionary. And in Kathleen's mind, she said she doesn't think that she meant it as a compliment, but she really took it as one. She really did.
And one of the things I understand that she disagreed with was that women's position actually diminished after independence.
Yeah, and it really has done in Ireland. And it's funny how, it's strange that the work that the women did back then has so, it's great to see it now in recent months, especially with all of the celebrations and the commemoration of the centenary. It's been spoken about finally, but it really was kind of swept under the carpet, like the groundwork that they did. There's just this kind of idea that like the women made sandwiches for the men and that was all that they did, whereas they were actually out on the streets. They were doing first aid training, but they were also doing rifle practice. They were fighting. They were in the thick of it. And the proclamation, it's funny, and this is why I love her story as well, because she such an insight into it because of the role that she had in the IRB and with the Supreme Council, that the night of the proclamation, it's very clear on that it's to the men and women of Ireland and it's equal citizens. And that's why it's such an amazing document of its time. It's kind of still looked at today as something that is quite forward thinking for 1916. But she said there was one man who signed it, wouldn't say who, and I have tried desperately to find out, but one of the signatories who disagreed with that statement, but the rest of them absolutely stood their ground on it. So he didn't believe that equal opportunities should have been given to women. So I think she, it just goes to show you the frame of mind at that time and how that kind of digressed over time in Ireland. I don't know how or why, but I'm sure it's something that will be, I think in hindsight, the more we, further we move away from it, you know, the way you can look back objectively. But yeah, I think she would be quite perplexed, I suppose, would be the word, to see how things are still quite uneven.
And what's brought you to this point in your career? What's your background?
I'm originally obviously from Ireland and I trained in Dublin and I have been over in London now for 3 years. This is my third year here. I came over with the Commitments musical because I worked a lot in theatre and in musical theatre at home in Dublin and around Ireland, and that moved us over here. And since then, yeah, we've stayed. And I don't know, I think sometimes when you leave home, when you leave somewhere, I've become nearly more Irish being over here, because your identity, especially in somewhere like London, it really matters. Do you know, because it's such a, you kind of, it's such an overwhelming city. It's like fantastic, but it's such a mixing pot of like different cultures and races and ethnicities that suddenly your own identity becomes something that you kind of cling on to a bit more. So that's, it's been wonderful to see the support and the community that actually is over here that I was kind of very unaware of until I started doing this project. So it's been great.
And you've most recently been working in Billy Elliot, haven't you?
That's right, still am, yes. So I'm taking a week off of Billy Elliot to stage A Fit Wife for a Revolutionary, which is great. And then I'm back in there, and that's closing now in a couple of weeks after 11 years in the West End. So it's going to be an end, the end of an era.
It's an amazing time to be in Billy Elliot.
It is, actually. It's lovely because it's quite a special time. The last show, I'd say, is going to be quite an emotional day.
So what for you after that then?
Well, the plan is back to the drawing board, as always, because that's the nature of the business. But we're really hopeful that we'll be able to stage A Fit Wife, which is our short working title, A Fit Wife. we're hoping that we'll be able to bring that around the country towards the end of the summer and in the autumn. We're hoping to actually bring it back to Ireland as well, to Dublin and to Limerick, which is her hometown. So we've got that in the pipeline. And then I also have another one-woman show I do, the Liza Minnelli story, which I'm going to be doing down in Brighton Fringe and then Manchester Greater Fringe. So that's kind of the plan. We'll see what happens.
That's fantastic. So you think you'll be staying in Britain for a bit longer?
Oh,
I
definitely think so, yeah. I really have to say I love it here. I can't believe how quickly 3 years have gone by. And you still don't feel like you've even scratched the surface of London, do you know?
So the Liza Minnelli show, is that set? Do you have dates for that?
That is in, and I should know them, it's the 6th to the 13th of May, and it's in the Brighton Fringe.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with that. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's great to chat to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.